you everybody for coming on what feels like second day of horrible bitter winter. So I'm hoping that this evening you will be embraced by some intellectual warmth, courtesy of this gentleman here. I'm very, very pleased to be here to launch this book, The Palestinian Novel. Bashir, let's start by talking about why you wanted to write it, because I'm very surprised to see that it is the first book in English about, you know, tracing the development of Palestinian novelists from 1948 to the present. That surprises me hugely.
Yes.
Why is there nothing else? And so is that why you chose to write it, because there was this huge gap?
Yeah, absolutely. So in part, I was surprised that there's a lot of work on Palestinian poetry, now more recent work on the Palestinian short story.
Yeah, can you talk a little louder?
Some of the novels. It takes me time to project. But there isn't a book that traces the trajectory or the history of the novel and makes an argument about the way the novel develops. So in a sense, it's a book I wanted to read. Which is
That's always the one people say you should write.
In a sense, I felt on some level, because of the nature of the Palestinian question, obliged to write it. I felt the way the Palestinian question is discussed is usually using certain tropes, certain kind of political history, certain kinds of problems. So in part, I wanted, as it were, to try to change the conversation, to open the range of the text and the problems that we talk about when we think about the Palestinian question, especially from a Palestinian perspective. So that's another way I thought about why it's good to have a book on the novel. And also to think about 1948 and its constitutive impact.
Okay, well you talk about that a lot in the book. So the way in which the book is structured is that you've chosen four writers, the Baghdad exiled Ibrahim Jabra, the Beirut exiled Ghassan Kanafani, Haifa-based Emil Habibi, and the Nablus-based Saha Khalife, who is the only female in that collection and the only one who is still living.
Yes.
Let's start. I don't necessarily want to go in chronological order, but it is interesting that you choose to start with Jabra, and you start with a very potent story, which is symbolic of everything that comes after that. So tell us that story. It's about what happened in Baghdad in 2010.
So as a result of the war in Iraq, what used to be Jabra's house was bombed, and Jabra kept a lot of books, manuscript. He was deeply involved in the Arab cultural scene, so he was involved in the Arab poetry, Arab art. He was a painter himself. So bombing of that house, which was essentially a sort of a museum of Arab culture in the last 50, 60 years, was losing everything that Jabra had there, was losing all those links that he had with Arab writers, Arab culture in Baghdad in the last 50, 60 years. So the question became for me, how do you try to rebuild that when you don't? And that's in part a Palestinian question. It's a question for all those who suffer dispossession, lose their libraries, lose their archives, how you can rebuild everything that was lost without having the raw material there, because the house was bombed, most of the manuscripts were lost, most of the books were lost. We don't know. In the other side of what I do is English literature. So when you talk about English literature, there's a lot that you have as a critic. You have you have letters, you have diaries, you have the manuscripts, you have the scribbles on the sides of the manuscripts. There's a lot of information for critics to work with. With the Arab world, it's very difficult to piece together that raw material, which critics usually need in order to make judgments about the novel. And when you lose a museum of culture, which was Jabra's house, like that, you've just been completely distanced from this reality, and maybe it was lost forever. So the only thing we have to access this problem, to access his worldview, to access his connections, to try to speculate on why he thought, why he did what he did, was to look at the novel. So the novel becomes, in a sense, this remnant that gives us access to a whole political, historical, and cultural moment. So.
And actually, later on in your book, when you're talking about Emil Habibi, there is a moment which is so potent, having read about Jabra's house being destroyed, where an Israeli politician, Yigal Alon, said that Palestinians didn't exist any longer, for if they did, they would have produced their own literature.
Yeah.
And in a way, what he was trying to do in a particular novel, in the footnotes that he included in a novel, which is very unusual for a work of fiction, was to try and create exactly what you're saying, which is a kind of body of work which forces people to sit up and notice that, yes, indeed, it's ridiculous to posit that Palestinians don't exist.
Absolutely. So, in part, a lot of Palestinian writers write against the Israeli version of themselves, of their society, and that's something which is constitutive. So people are constantly responding, and this is also one of the main reasons that I wrote the book. People are constantly responding to charges of terrorism, to charges of a culture of incitement, to charges that Palestinian culture is simply much less important than any other cultures or Israeli culture, or it doesn't really exist, the Palestinians are not a people. So from day one, as it were, and especially for Habibi, and because Habibi experienced the brunt of this Israeli attack because he was inside Israel, because he was in Haifa, and because he had to fight under very different circumstances than Jabra in Baghdad, who had more leeway, more breadth of Arab culture to deal with. Because of those circumstances, he had to fight from day one, and he had to force the Israelis to recognize and to reckon with Palestinian culture. And that's what The Pesoptimist does, the novel that he ended up writing. That's also, in part, he's such a controversial figure, but, you know, controversial writers make it interesting for critics.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about the controversy that he found himself at the heart of in a moment. Let's go back to Jabra, because there is so much about what he attempts to do from the absolute get-go that he tell us a little bit more about him, because his origins were working class, and yet at the heart of his novels are intellectuals. He doesn't write about working class people in the way that Ghassan Kanafani did.
So Jabra, if you want to compare him to an English version, let's say, of what Jabra could have become in terms of aesthetics and politics, Jabra is essentially a Palestinian D.H. Lawrence. Right? He was even poorer than D.H. Lawrence. D.H. Lawrence came from a mining family, working class family. Jabra came from essentially dirt poor family. His parents were lent a house in the back of a church in Bethlehem where he grew up. His father had health problems. He didn't have regular income, so the family just got by. So this is a story, there's a heroic side to Jabra. This is a story of somebody who comes from the utter and complete margins of Palestinian society and then becomes one of the most important writers in the Arab world. And that journey is, in a sense, entangled with his exile, leaving Baghdad, leaving Bethlehem, and becoming at the center of modernizing Arab culture in Baghdad, one of the vanguard of Arab culture in Baghdad, and mixing with Iraqi and Arab intellectuals. So that trajectory is extremely important for Jabra. It defines Jabra as a writer, but it also meant the way he responded to his class background is just he left it all behind. So he never, there's no, other than his autobiography, the first volume of his autobiography. If you want to look for the texture of working class life in Palestine in the 30s, what that meant, a lot of the details that you find with Kanafani, for example, about what it means to be poor, what it means to be dispossessed, exiled, it's very difficult to get those details in Jabra because everything is mediated through his main trope.
Why do you think he did that? Because that was clearly a conscious choice.
So that's a very difficult question. I think in part because he saw himself as a romantic rebel. And I think he had this image of Shelley and Byron in the background, and he thought, well, this is what you could do as an intellectual. You could be a revolutionary rebel using cultural form without actively involving yourself with daily organizational or political struggles. So you could make that impact. So I think the way he modeled himself was like that. Many people at the time thought that, especially in the 50s and the 60s, before the rise of more politicized mass movements, that the intellectuals are somehow the redeemers of the Arab cause, the intellectuals have a key and leading role to play. So when the guerrillas arose in the 70s, he said it's as if for him Palestinian history, active history, is speaking to something he'd imagined in his novels. He says, well, you know, I imagined this in my novel. This is what I always wanted. So there's a sense in which it speaks to the period he was in. There's a sense in which aesthetic choices he makes. this was his most comfortable trope. There are moments in his work where he veers out of it a little bit. There are moments where he bumps into peasants and he says, everything I'm doing in my life, all project of modernization, the Renaissance, the challenge of power, I'm doing it for this peasant woman, right? The drape. So there are moments when he meets people outside of his narrow confines. But the reason, the other reason, the romantic rebel conception is key for him, but the other reason, I think, is because Jabra always saw himself as emulating the life of Jesus. Here you have a little poor Palestinian like him who came from the margins of society and who became such an important figure globally and internationally, and who sacrificed himself for poor people, for outcasts, for prostitutes. He came for the poor, he didn't come for the rich. So he saw himself as performing that role. It feeds into the way he writes his novels.
Yeah, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about this notion of self-sacrifice in his writing. Explain how it manifests itself in the novels.
So the way different critics do it differently, so it has to do a lot with the way I was trained and the way I look at literature. So somebody else would have written this book differently, so I don't want to tell you that this is the only way to write about the Palestinian novel. I come with my own axes to grind and my own problems and my own intellectual makeup. But one way to try to gauge how people change in the way they write this across a long period of time is to follow one trope and to see how that trope changes. The fundamental trope that Jabra has in his work is self-sacrifice. So from day one, from his first novel, which was first written in English, then translated into Arabic in 1946, written in Jerusalem, Screams in a Long Night, the first trope he creates is this figure of the intellectual who sacrifices himself in order so society modernizes, redeems the sins of society, society is improved. That is the key trope, and he follows that trope through. So all his novels deal with this group of self-sacrificing intellectuals who see social and historical and political problems of the Arab world and impale themselves, right, and suffer in order to redeem the sins of Arab society and in order to improve it. That continues. If you follow it through, that initially is a very Arab trope. So initially it's a romantic trope. Then it becomes an Arab trope. So the Palestinian is part of a group of other Arabs who combine and talk about various things that they talked about in the 50s and the 60s. Existentialism, commitment, how to change society, the impact of the desert. Hunters in an Arab Street in 1960 epitomizes this moment. But as this goes along and as this develops, the trope, the Palestinian at the end of it, in Search of Walid Mas'ud, which was published in 1978 after the defeat of the Palestinian revolution, after its shrinking into only Palestinian, the Palestinian sphere, it's only the Palestinians who are trying to do all these changes. The Arabs sort of fell away. And the Palestinian is, in a sense, carries a burden
which, of the universal.
Absolutely, and the burden of the Arab. Before, he had other people working with him in order to formulate this project and to counter Zionism and to counter Israel and to redeem Palestine. Now he feels he's alone. And he sort of, Walid Mas'ud is about the disappearance of this Palestinian who becomes, the more history evolves, he gains more symbolic dimensions and he becomes essentially like Jesus, right? He becomes that figure which everybody asks about why he's disappeared, what happened to him. But everybody's searching for him. Nobody does anything in their own society. So it becomes a story about the loss of the shrinking of Palestinian political horizons and the loss of Arab challenge, which is why Jabra is so good on the Arab world.
And how much of an impact did him being in Baghdad make on him, in 1958 in particular in Iraq?
Huge, because he witnessed the end of the older regimes that essentially lost Palestine. So if you think about 1948 as a systemic moment in the Arab world, all the regimes and the social classes at the time who were seen to be responsible for the loss of Palestine, one after the other they fell within the first decade. It happened in Egypt with the new officers, and it happens with Qasim in 1958. So he saw revolt again in 58, the same revolt he saw in 36 in Palestine. Now, because he's so intellectual, it grips his imagination. He understands the significance of social change and transformation. He wants to ally with it. He wants it to happen, but he also fears it at the same time. So it puts him in a very difficult situation. In his literature, especially The Ship, which was written in 1970, that moment becomes a moment of huge social contradiction where the monarchic regime is overthrown in Iraq. That moment also becomes a moment of social division within the novel. So different characters take different sides in the revolution, and it still feeds into the way people respond later on. So it's definitional, but part of his aesthetic is to be able to say, these events are key to the way I'm going to think about the Arab world and the way I'm going to write about it, that sensitivity to revolt. Not many writers have that. Some writers, these things just pass them by without noticing, because they're
uninterested. But he was very self-conscious.
Absolutely.
About it. But what place did he occupy while he was writing these novels? How did people respond to the work that he wrote?
So he was a key figure in Iraqi culture. So essentially he became an Iraqi writer, part of the Iraqi scene, part of Jawad Salim's modernization project, famous painter. Who has Nusb al-Hurriya still up in destroyed Baghdad, that image of that he made in the late 50s. So he was part of the modernizing generation, part of the Iraqi generation, part of writers, painters, other literary figures, and seen as an Iraqi writer. So, and he also edited all development review. He was involved with that as well. He was close to, at some point, Abdurrahman Munif, and they combined and wrote a novel together. So he was one of the main pillars of Arab culture and Iraqi culture at the time. Iraqis see him as an Iraqi writer.
How much criticism was there of the fact that he did focus on the presence of the intellectuals in his novels? I mean, he was it was seen as
sure.
Bourgeois, wasn't it, in
Absolutely.
The context of the bigger political picture?
Yeah. So in the 70s, a new generation of critics, hugely important in Palestinian culture, especially in and around the PLO, who published Shu'un Palestiniya, Palestine Affairs, started generating what I think is some of the best criticism written in the Arab world, late 60s, 1970s. And for them, they wanted to know, what are we going to do with somebody like Jabra? Like Kanafani, we know what to do with Kanafani. Kanafani comes out of the movement, he's a revolutionary, you know, he's entangled with the PLO, he's also plebeian, he writes for the masses, he wants his work to impact the masses, etc. But what do we do with somebody like Jabra, who's deeply involved with intellectual questions and seems very aloof, right? So they called him a bourgeois writer, and he resented that. He always told them, I'm not a bourgeois writer. And he always fought with him, I'm not a bourgeois writer, because I'm a revolutionary writer. So on some level, writing about Jabra, I could have followed this path. And it's not a difficult path to follow, because Jabra doesn't make it difficult to be dubbed that way. That's his interest and that's his sphere. But, you know, sometimes different historical moments require different things from critics. I thought this was done, and this was done very well. A lot of the critics in the 70s did it very well, and I appreciate what they did. But I thought, how could you redeem the revolutionary aspects of Jabra and think about the way he actively challenged the Arab world, rather than, because if he's accused of being a bourgeois writer, then he's accused of being pro-status quo, wanting to maintain things the way they are, believes in oppression, supports it, in fact. But everything he did was against it.
And to what extent, you mentioned Shelley, and he was clearly hugely influenced by Western thought and
yes.
Western writers too. Tell us a little bit about the kinds of writers he was drawn to.
So the Romantics, Faulkner, that was a key. He translated Shakespeare into Arabic, all the canonical writers. And there's a story that gets spun about Jabra. One is the bourgeois writer story. The other is because he was so involved with what critics deem modernist writers like Faulkner, people started talking about Jabra as a modernist writer. And part of what I wanted to do was essentially to fight this position, because I don't think he's a modernist writer. I think he's a modernizer, but not all modernizers are modernists. And because there's so much complacency about modernism in contemporary culture, because if you want to be edgy and you want to be cosmopolitan, you want to be sophisticated, you have to write in fragmented narratives and you have to jumble up and have to sound very difficult, and then people will say, this is smart writing. And then everything else that the third world has spent 40 years doing, or even the English novel, suddenly becomes banal and uninteresting. And so I thought Jabra is the perfect example of somebody who himself was a modernizer but was not a modernist. And then the question becomes for me to ask, when does he become a modernist? So in part, it's linked to Palestinian history, and I argue that he becomes a modernist in the 80s, when that self-sacrificing probe fails completely. So that's another side of the argument of what I wanted to do with Jabra, is also to argue against this notion that he was a modernist, and also because he was so involved with translating modernist culture, Eliot, the Golden Bough, Faulkner. So he was seen as that kind of figure.
And in the context of the nationalism around the political responses to exile, how did he fit into that? How did he speak about that in his novels, if not in the way in which he shaped culture in Iraq?
So the question about exile, how he saw himself as an exile? So there was a certain route that he drew in his writings and in his imagination, which is a route of how to return to Palestine. And that was a fundamental question for him. For him, the loss of Beit Lahem and the loss of Jerusalem was like nothing you could imagine. This was the core of his being. And everything, his life in Iraq gains meaning and could be explained by the mechanisms and the ways he tries to find to return to that moment of loss, war, love. Right? He had an amazing, one of the novels that conveys an amazing love affair in Jerusalem. His lover dies in 48. So there's a lot of pain and drama around 48 for him. So the question becomes, how do you get back to Palestine? What is a mechanism of return for him? And he, what's distinctive about Jabra is to argue, that's what makes, I think, a lot of Palestinian nationalists slightly uncomfortable with him, other than the bourgeois dimensions, is that he had an Arab answer to this question, not just a Palestinian answer. So his answer says, I want to return to Palestine. The only way for me to return to Palestine is to change the Arab world. And that's the ambition. Because if we don't change the Arab world, we will never be able to return to Palestine, because Palestinians are too weak to be able to defeat the Israelis. And too weak to be able to gain any kind of justice. So you have to change the Arab world in order to get more leverage and power in order to do so. So that's where his intervention lies. And that's what makes him such a great Arab writer. Is he a Palestinian nationalist? On some level, yes. But it's a kind of nationalism which is so deeply saturated with so many other tropes that I don't know what it means to say that he's a nationalist.
I mean, it's informed by the rupture that he feels personally, so it must inform, at some level, his life as an intellectual.
Yeah, absolutely. He's also one of the writers that there are no Israeli characters in his writings.
Okay, that brings us very, very neatly into talking about...
I don't
about
know if you want to go there. But,
why? Why did he choose that to be something that he thought was... defensible as a writer, that he didn't feel that he had to have any Israeli characters?
So I thought the problem was with him. Right? I thought, here you have one version of this. Here you have an Arab nationalist who doesn't know how to tackle this idea of Israel as an existent reality, so the only way you can do is just deny it. Right? So you live, you fight, you formulate a culture in the Arab world without thinking about this one thing which is there, like a rock on all our chests. Okay, I thought that's a plausible way of thinking about Jabra. But then I thought the same is with Habibi. Habibi, who was a member of the Knesset for over 20 years, whose daily life was living with Israeli Jews, cooperating with them, coordinating with them politically, who was a member of the Israeli Communist Party, right, which was, in a sense, a binational party. But you look at his literature and you look at the Post-Optimist, you find the same thing. Habibi, all the Israeli characters in Habibi, there's one Israeli character in Jabra, which comes out of 48, a soldier, brutal presence, etc. But then all Habibi's characters are like that. All the Israelis in Habibi are security officers, Israeli repressive figures, Israeli army officers, the big brother, another figure. None of them are ordinary Israelis that you can talk to or cooperate with or discuss the Palestinian question or discuss your suffering with. Even the Mizrahi character in Habibi is that. So I thought, okay, well, you know, then it's not just a Jabra problem. Then the answer has to be connected with 1948, because both of them, the only way they could think about Israel is to think about 1948. That's what Israel is for them.
And that's what one of the things that makes Ghanafani very different, because he is absolutely rooted in the political nationalism, the active political nationalism of Palestine. But in his novels, he makes a conscious effort to humanize the Israeli. So just tell us that story and how. I mean, you know, this is a man who was assassinated at the age of 36, and goodness
like
knows what
on some level.
Yeah, what he could have become and what he could have done. So I mean, I'm going to ask you about that in a moment, but just tell us that story of how it was possible for him to humanize Israelis in his fiction. Is it completely rooted to the fact that he's thinking much more as 67 being the watershed moment as opposed to 48?
So that's the 47 argument, where Israel occupies the West Bank and Gaza and becomes a presence which you can't ignore. So you have to engage with it and you have to try to think about how to change it. Some people think about, and I have a little axe to grind with Saeed on this. Some people think about that generation of writers, Palestinian.
Deep intake of breath and axe to grind with Edward Said. Okay, continue.
Not if you're in my household. We grind axes all the time.
Okay.
So there's an image that Said popularized, which is that the Palestinians in the late 60s and 70s, the ones who formulated the PLO, the revolutionary Palestinians, never thought about Israel. And, okay, I thought, you want to defeat it, you don't want to think about it, fine. But then when you flip through the journals that the PLO, especially Shu'un Falastini, they're obsessed with Israel. You say, okay, drop this, let's talk about the Arab world, right? One issue after another, political parties, how many candidates, who are the candidates, it just goes on and on. So this notion that the Palestinians did not study Israel, and that's why we failed in our struggle, is just completely not true. So Ghanafani comes out of this reality. In fact, he wrote an MA in Syria about Zionist literature. And he thought that Zionist literature was unfair to the Jews because it dehumanized them, because it treated them as stereotypes. And what he wanted to do in his own fiction is to give portraits of Jews and Israeli Jews in his novels, which are better than Zionist literature. So, you know, he was competing with the Israelis on some level, right, over this question. He thought, okay, you don't know how to humanize your own people, I'm going to humanize your own people. And the fundamental act of humanization that he does is in his novel Returning to Haifa, which is published in 1969, 2 years after the 67 war, and I think it's his most important novel politically. Men in the Sun is obviously, you know, all the modernists love Men in the Sun. There are a little bit flashbacks, you think back, you think forward, but the real contradiction of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in all its complexity is actually Returning to Haifa, where the Palestinian refugee who is dispossessed and kicked out of Haifa returns after 1967, because you could if you lived in the West Bank when Israel occupies all of Palestine. There were a couple of weeks where a lot of Palestinians made that journey, where you wanted to go and see what happened to our house in Haifa, what happened to our field in Yafa. So people just took the car and drove. So the story is about, so Ghanafani picks up on this social process, in a sense. And he writes a novel about this couple that return. And the site of injury becomes not only the fact that there's somebody, another family, who occupies the house, but also that they, in the rush of leaving Haifa, being expelled from Haifa, they left their child behind. And their child, who is Khaldun, becomes Dov. So he meets his son, who's now in the Israeli army. I mean, it doesn't get, you know, the story. It doesn't get more difficult than that. And the person who occupies the house now is Miriam Koshen, who is a Holocaust survivor. So you have the Palestinian question meeting, and she's a non-Zionist. She came to Palestine because she had nowhere else to go. She didn't like what she saw. She didn't like the dehumanization that she witnessed by the Zionists, and she thought, I'm going to leave. And the only reason she stays is because she's given this baby to take care of, and she couldn't have children. So, you know, there's a lot of complexity around why she ends up staying.
It's an astonishing story.
An astonishing story. So then, Ghanafani wants to resolve this problem. He tells you, okay, you know, you want the Palestinian question? So if you think that Palestinians are not sophisticated about how they think about that question, think again. They are absolutely, if you think that Palestinians don't think about or contemplate the effects of the Holocaust, think again. If you think that Palestinians shouldn't represent Israelis in literature, this is 1969. Think again. This is telling the Arab world, this is your problem, right? We have somebody here who's a non-Zionist, who stayed not because of Zionist reasons, who stayed because she's a refugee from the Holocaust, who's now occupying your house, who's even brought up your kid, your child, and who tells you, come and have a look around your house. I know this is yours. How can you reject her? So it makes it not only, so the attack is dual, as it were. It's on the Israelis for doing all of this and facilitating the expulsion and dispossession. And it's also on the Arab world and telling them, you know, this is the reality you have to deal with. Some of the people in Israel are victims. How are you gonna deal with that?
Right? It's interesting that he invests the humanity in Miriam, in the female character, and not necessarily in the husband, because she has that conversation with him about the throwing this child into the back of a truck.
Yes.
And you know, he doesn't care about that, whereas she has this very strong sense that the child is treated as a piece of wood.
Yes.
And how, you know, and if it was a Jewish child, it wouldn't be treated in that way. And I think that's quite interesting that he chooses to invest the humanity in the female character much more.
Yes.
Why do you think he does that?
I mean, there's a care dimension. There's also problems of he had with masculine men. So a lot of the problems of, if you trace some of his conceptions of masculinity in the novels, a lot of the characters who lose Palestine were infatuated with their masculinity. Their masculinity was so inflated that it was unrealistic, which meant that they couldn't have a realistic bearing. So a lot of it is that. I think it's a complicated question, because his wife in the novel, the main character, is silent most of the time. She cries. And yet the engagement and the activity is with the Israeli woman. So whether it's a question about how he portrays women in his novels, it's a complicated question. Mm. It's not an easy question to resolve. But part of what I wanted to do with this novel, because there were certain prototypes of how you interpret Returning to Haifa. And one of the main prototypes was dominant reading of it, is that you gauge this reality, you look at the contours of the Palestinian conflict, and then at the end of it, the main character says, there's only war that will resolve this. So it's always read as an armed struggle novel, because Kanafani was subscribing to the armed struggle. The only way you could resolve this question is through violence, Palestinian violence to counter Israeli violence, la-di-da. Okay, I thought that was plausible, because the ending is a strong ending. But then I thought, because novels work in their form as well, not only in what they say, Kanafani spends most of the time on a moral encounter, an argument. Mm. He spends most of the time arguing with the characters and telling them, this is not just, and what you have done, you have dominated other people. And a homeland to me is a place where there is relations of non-domination, where there are relations of mutuality, where we can be equal. This is not a homeland. That's my concern. So Kanafani turns it around into a universal story rather than either a nationalist story or a story about armed struggle, because he spends most of his time fleshing out this moral dimension. So it's undeniable, the armed struggle dimension is undeniable. I don't think it would have been possible for Kanafani not to say armed struggle.
Well, because of his own political education.
Yeah, because
education.
Of the milieu.
Yeah, and where he sat in that particular politics. But what's really interesting about him as an intellectual is that he talks about not the politics coming first, but the literature coming first.
Absolutely.
And that's so fascinating, given that, you know, he was assassinated for being the political figure that he was.
Yeah, I mean, the Israeli assassination of Kanafani is just part of what now is described as mowing the lawn in Gaza. You want to crop the heads. So Kanafani was a very popular figure. He was a figure that spoke good English. He had contacts with the outside world. People who came to visit the Palestinian Revolution would meet Kanafani, etc. He was part of the progressive wing of the PLO. He was part of the revolutionary wing, less nationalist, more interested in Arab integration. So if you wanted to take out the progressive leaderships, Kanafani would be a good target. But he was a cultural figure. He never carried guns. He never was never himself involved in the armed struggle. So, you know, morally, in terms of international law these days. But anyway.
But it is also, it does, doesn't it go to the heart of how incredibly potent culture is.
Absolutely.
It's not just from the point of view of the enemy wanting to cut the head off of a particular individual, but in the context of the political movement, the nationalist movement, how crucial the culture was.
Yeah, absolutely. And his own trajectory was one where he felt, in fact, forced to become politically involved. Because what he was interested in was literature. So he was extremely faithful to literature. This is what he wanted to develop. He wanted to see, have a worldview, develop a worldview through literary acts. But then he found, so there's something very authentic about this move. But then he found that a lot of the problems that he was facing, that he was experiencing, didn't have literary solutions. And that became tragic for him. But then you couldn't resolve the problem of suffering. You couldn't resolve the problem of crushed individuals. You had to do something else. So he felt he was compelled to act politically. And yet kept faith with literature and wanted to formulate a literature which was combative, but also faithful to its literariness, as it were.
So in that context, where would you place Emil Habibi? I mean, clearly a controversial figure because he was seen by those who felt that he was not necessarily a collaborator, but he was too complicit with the structures of Israel. In that, as you explained, you know, he was a member of the Communist Party, he sat in the Knesset from 52 until, almost probably until his death, didn't he? And that he took an Israeli prize, he was also given a prize by Yasser Arafat. You know, there is this position that he occupied that made him somebody who wanted to occupy both literary and political, because he felt that you could talk peace, that you could actually try and understand the other, and yet that didn't help him very much.
So then you ask the question, why did Habibi write, right?
Yeah.
Literature. So initially Habibi, like Kanafani, was a literary writer. He worked in the BBC, actually, radio, in Jerusalem. His lover died in the destruction of the King Hotel. So he had a lot of memories coming out of the 30s. And then there's a lot of his writings come out of the 30s, and then he stops. So he stops until he's nudged into writing again late 60s. And then 67 becomes that key moment for him. So you ask the question, well, why does Habibi write? I have to be completely honest, that was the most difficult chapter for me to write. Because it's closest to home. In so many ways, there are so many criticisms that are made of the Communist Party and its behavior in Israel, being complicit, collaborationist, having a certain role in 1948, etc. So figures like Habibi these days are on the defensive. They are all seen as having been too close to the Israelis. So I reject that narrative. I think it's the wrong narrative about Habibi and about that whole generation. And there was one line that opened this whole question for me. He said, and that where I could just place Habib, right? Where you could place and understand his worldview and understand his political behavior, understand why he wrote. He says, I cry when my form of crying is writing. And then you can formulate a relationship between politics and literature. So for him, everything he had to do, what he saw as his political responsibility, was in politics. He had to talk with the Israelis, he had to try to convince them of peace, he had to dwell on the Nakba, dwell on Palestinian rights, dwell on refugees, he had to fight the Israelis, everything he politically. But he saw literature as his realm of freedom. And in his realm of freedom, the Israelis are completely brutal occupiers. And to remain faithful to his memories and to his own conception of the role of literature, he had to write that. So he is most, of all the writers, I think, where you could truly understand the nature of the Zionist project, its constitutive aggression is in Habib. Mm. There's a segment I quote, a long segment, in the Psoptimist. And it's heart. It gives you a heartache when you read that quote. And you understand the contradictions of Habibi. The section in the novel which is biographical, where when he returns, as he's being driven back by an Israeli officer because of his certain contacts in biographical life he had with the Communist Party, he he's allowed to return to Haifa, unlike all the others who are coming out. Mm. Right? The refugees are coming out, everybody's being dispossessed, but Habib is being driven back in. So the sense of guilt is tremendous. Mm. And then he bumps into a refugee who is being, who had been expelled and is trying to come back to her village, carrying a small child. And that's a constitutive moment. So 48 is Habibi's moment. And he looks, he can't do anything. He freezes, and the officer stands up and tells the woman in the novel and also in real life, "Didn't I tell you to go? Why are you coming back to your village? Go now." So she turns around, holds her hand, son's hand, and then starts walking and leaves, is dispossessed yet again, expelled yet again. And the difficulty of this situation for Habibi is that he does nothing to stop it. So he feels utterly and completely guilty and complicit in that sense. And then the other dimension of it, where Habibi's imagination comes in, where he says, as they were leaving, and as the sun was setting, I could see that their figures were becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and that they overshadowed all of the land. Right. So that there's something about refugee presence which one day will overshadow that land, because their presence is completely felt and is still there for him. So that's constitutive for Habib. That's where Habibi lives. That moment of, I don't want to use trauma because it's overused, right, but that moment of real pain, real rupture, and real violence against him, his conception of his capacities, against, of him as a defeated person, it doesn't get... The 48th generation, unlike the 67th generation, they experience defeat in different ways. When you talk to that generation, you can see fear in their eyes. You can't see that in the 67th generation. 67th generation fought, but had a different moment in history. 48 was savage, truly savage. Massacres, rapes, tens of massacres in Palestine. 531 towns and villages dispossessed, destroyed immediately. One person told me once that you should fear the Israelis because you never know what they're capable of. And that comes out of 48. For our generation, we fear them less. We know what they're capable of. We see it every day in the West Bank and Gaza when they destroy.
But also there was hope because resistance came out of 67 as
sure,
well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't want to leave too little time to speak about the only female writer that you're looking at, Zaha Khalifeh. You say at the beginning of that chapter that no Palestinian writer has subjected Palestinian society to as radical a political and social critique as she has. Explain why and how.
So Sahar, the only way to understand Sahar Khalifeh is to understand that she's a socialist feminist. There's no way you can turn this around without... So for her, the reason why the Palestinians are defeated is because there are so many problems in Palestinian society that need to be resolved. And one of the key problems is the relationship between men and women, women's oppression. And another key problem is class oppression and exploitation. So you have to resolve those questions in order to gain full emancipation. Right? So she's deeply involved. She's a Fanonist writer in that sense. She replicates Fanon. Because Fanon saw the end product of, as it were, emancipation or freedom, not just as national collective freedom, but ultimately as individual freedom. Right? So Sahar Khalifeh lives there, lives in the moment of what it means for individuals to be free, especially for women to be free. So, and she begins to write in this moment when there's a lot of hope, when the women's Palestinian movement is coalescing, starting to come together, when it's starting to challenge the nationalist movement. It arises at the moment with the nationalism, but then it challenges it, it makes demands on it. And then she traces this problem until Palestinian women and progressive forces are defeated. And you have the rise of the Islamic movements, which want to do everything to reverse the progressive dimensions of Palestinian culture. Send women back to the home, or for them to be subservient to men. They don't talk about class, they are not concerned with class, the only thing they're concerned with is Islamizing society. For her, it drove her crazy, this problem. Right? I mean, because we were on the cusp of fighting all these things, and now she felt completely on the defensive. And she felt that the Israelis have a huge role to play in this, because they ultimately defeated the First Intifada. So if you think about where her literature, you know, ultimately expresses itself politically, it's in the First Intifada. The first year of the First Intifada is everything she ever wanted from her literature, right, gets articulated there. But then immediately after the first year of the First Intifada, you start seeing how other forces come into play. And she's also the most deeply critical of Palestinian official nationalism. She's against armed struggle. She thinks armed struggle is utterly and completely romantic. You needed something which was much more, like kind of Fanny on some level, which were much more in touch with social and political mobilization, which involved democratizing Palestinian society and allowing it to transform itself, which was much more about self-organization, self-participation, not about, I'm going to give you this formula and tell you how to resolve this question and let's kill a couple of people. So she's much more radical. So she subjects Palestinian society to a deep critique based on class and based on women's freedom, which is unparalleled.
And when you talk about her as a Fanon-esque figure, you also evoke Fanon when you talk about Canifani.
Yes.
So is it in her mind that there's a direct connection between the writers who've come before her? Or not? Is she?
Yes.
Okay.
So, but she fights them. So she fights Habibi. Habibi, she argues with him in an exchange when she publishes her second novel. He doesn't like the novel because he thinks that she presents Palestinians who work in Palestinians in the West Bank who work in Israel as somehow having better wages and having a better life because they work in Israel. And he tells her off. He tells this is not a nationalist position to have. And she told him, okay, you know, let's talk about your nationalism. Who are these nationalists that are helping the Palestinians? It's certainly not the bourgeois class in Nablus. They're not helping the Palestinians. The Palestinian refugees rotted away for months without receiving crumbs from the Palestinian elite. Why should I defend Palestinian nationalism? On what basis? On the basis of national solidarity? There is no national solidarity. What are you talking about? I defend the rights of ordinary people. I defend the rights of workers. That's whom I defend. So even with him, she felt she had to fight him because what she was articulating was something unique. And she comes out of a moment, so that's when history comes into play, right? She comes out of a moment not only of feminism, international feminism, her association with the feminist movement in the US, etc., but also a far more developed third worldist moment, a far more developed revolutionary moment, and what was happening in the West Bank and Gaza at the time. You had an educated generation coming through the universities who wanted to formulate a new challenge to Israel. She participated in that. So there are a lot of distinct, but I think it's correct to see her and Canifani as doing the same thing. Canifani being a revolutionary nationalist who's also a socialist, and her being thinking in those same terms, but with a radical feminist twist.
I have more questions, but I'm going to open it up to the floor. Can you wait for a microphone so that everyone can hear?
This is it.
Oh, you're so shy.
I always tell my students, you can object as well.
Yes. It doesn't have to be just a question.
By all means. It'll wake me up.
Clearly not.
She's been too nice.
Properly.
She's been
oh
too nice.
God.
Now. I gave it.
Oh, look, there we are. Excellent. First brave person.
Thank you. I know it's not what you focused on, but I wonder if you could tell me who you think, from a literary point of view, is the best author.
Well, I think I know.
Okay.
Well, I would say that you argue that it's Jabra.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm glad it comes through.
It certainly does.
I tried not to say it. So, in terms of somebody who's deeply involved with developing an aesthetic, right? Not just a commitment to a political cause or a commitment to a historical reality, but somebody who spends a lot of time on thinking about literature as a certain kind of aesthetic, right? I think it's Jabra. I think Jabra is one of the neglected cultural figures in the Arab world. But I also think that Jabra, that's where Jabra needs to be appreciated. And that's where I think Jabra's sting against Arab society, Arab dictatorships, the Arab regimes, against Arab unfreedom, that's where his sting lies. And the fact that he sustained the project, right, on its own terms for such a long period of time, 8 novels, and also did so many other things. So if I want to revive anybody, right, I think Canifani is doing very well in the academy. We teach at Canifani. I think Habibi could be doing better. He's being attacked these days too much. Maybe we can talk about the Israel Prize. So I think it has work to do with Habibi. I think Sahar is doing okay in general, right, as a figure, in terms of criticism about her, interest about her. Jabra's not. And I think that's the problem, because Jabra gives you a completely different narrative about what it means to be Palestinian, which is a key narrative, which is the notion that being Palestinian is being Arab. And all there's a Palestinian-centric way of thinking about being Palestinian, that this is just our cause, we suffer through it, we have to bear the brunt of this. I mean, please, it's exhausting, this position. And it will not allow us to do anything politically. And I think where Jabra had the right instincts and the right sphere of influence, as it were, to develop this kind of critique. So it is Jabra to answer the question. I confess.
More questions.
So I hope everyone can hear me. I don't need the mic. How would you say, or where would you say the future?
You're being given it anyway.
Okay. What would you say is the future of the Palestinian novel? I mean, recently you feel there is a stall in Palestinian literature, specifically in the novel.
So, if I want to be positive about things,
go ahead.
If you want to spin a positive story out of this, there's a positive story to spin out of it. Palestinian novel. One version would be that the Palestinian novel is diversifying. It's being written not just in Palestine, but in many places. It's been written in the UK, it's been written in the US, a lot of refugees thinking about the Palestinian question, and this is a very good thing. So this notion that writing about Palestine, writing Palestinian novels, is not just something that's happening in Arabic. It's happening in Hebrew, it's happening in English, and that's going to happen, I think, more and more. In part because Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and inside Israel are exhausted from this, right? Utterly exhausted from what Israel does every day, all the time. So in part because the resources are being crushed and destroyed all the time. And in part because people outside have more facility, they have more time to write, more time to concentrate on things. That people who are trying to make a living all day, you wake up in the morning, you spend 4 hours trying to get into work, into Israel. Writing novels is not your first priority. So on some level, that's a good part of the story. On another level, there's a problem with contemporary Palestinian culture. I think it's an internal problem. It's a narcissistic generation, for my taste. It's a generation that thinks too much about their own individuality and how I feel and what I want and am I comfortable or not. It's a generation that doesn't understand politics. Doesn't understand if you perform your own selfhood, you're not doing anything. Everybody can perform their own selfhood. It's a generation that needs to formulate a new political strategy for Palestine, needs to engage with Palestine as a Palestinian and Arab cause. I think there's a lot of legwork that needs to be done there. It's a generation that needs to be more realistic about what it can do. There's a specific conversation we can have about that politically later on. I don't want to venture into it now, but it's about thinking what is realistic and what can be achieved. Politics is not about saying what you want in life. I want many things. I don't get them, right? And there's a reason why I don't get them. Politics is about finding a way to think about what you can get now in order to fortify your position so you can demand more. There's an element of realism about politics. So I think this generation, which is deeply seeped in postmodernism, I don't think that will help them think about the Palestinian question. I think it banalizes the Palestinian question. It's articulated much better in cinema. If you want me to name names, you just have to push me.
No.
my wife doesn't want me to name them, yeah. But it's articulated in Palestinian cinema much more. This notion of Palestinian narcissism as a key metaphor of how to tackle the Palestinian question. I think this leads nowhere. I think the Palestinians need to reinvent not only your politics, but an aesthetic which engages with what it means to be a Palestinian society, not just an isolated, atomized individual. So I think there's a lot of work to be done there.
Another question just there.
Thank you. I just want to follow on from that, actually. What's wrong with individuality and not caring about politics? Why would that?
There's nothing wrong with it.
I mean, you said we could object, so.
There's nothing wrong with it. But if you want to continue,
yeah, just following on, so why do you think that would affect the literacy? I mean, it could create a better literacy. Yeah?
So the argument goes. The question is, do we have a better literacy than what we had before? That's a real question. I don't wanna wish to undermine contemporary efforts or to sound as if I'm negative about what's happening now. That's not my intention. I'm just saying that there are certain ways of responding to contemporary problems which are too narcissistic. And if those remain or are, I don't think they're dominant, I think they're prominent. I don't think they're dominant. If that remains and grows and becomes a dominant way of responding to Palestinian culture, I think we lose. Absolutely. The notion of individuality is, read Jabra. You don't get more individuality than Jabra. And yet, you get this connection, right, with society and the collective, which is key for Jabra. The question is, do you find this, if you want to live as an individual only and satisfy your individual whims and desires, I'm not going to tell you no. Hey, by all means, do what you want to do. Aesthetically as well. Who am I to judge you? But as a society, Palestinians can't, I don't think they can, I don't think it will bring them justice.
What about consolation? I mean, is there more consolation? Are you arguing that there's more consolation in focusing on the collective in cultural terms?
I think because of the nature of the Palestinian question, individualist solutions, mainly politically, are non-solutions. I think the problem, there is something, there's a burden about being oppressed, right? And it's not a burden that people choose. It's a constraint. And working through this constraint, rather than ignoring this constraint, but working through it, is a fundamental part of political work. So there's no way for me to say, I'm not this or that, right? I'm born into certain confines, I'm born into certain constrictions. People who feel that every day they can invent who they are, my answer is, it's just because they can afford to do it. Most people don't. And that's the reality. So are we talking about some people? Fine, let's talk about some people. By all means. And let's talk about the cultural forms they produce. But if we're talking about a society at large which is producing a body of literature, that's a completely different argument to make, right? And that's a completely different category to use. And I think that's where individual solutions are. People take them, people develop them, people do with them whatever they want. Will that bring us closer politically to resolve the question of Palestine? I don't know. Does that need commitment? Yeah, I'm not shy about that.
But writers don't need to solve the political question.
No, but they don't need to do anything, writers. And I'm not prescribing. I'm not prescribing. I'm not telling you as a writer, do this. What I get is outcomes. Yeah. What I see is products. My job as a critic is to say what these products are about. I'm not telling writers you should write this way. I don't know how you should write. I don't write literature, and I avoid writing literature. I don't know. I don't know if there, I ever have one talented bone in my body. So I'm not going to pretend to tell you how you should write your literature. But I'm also not going to pretend to say that when you do write your literature, we're going to be innocent about it and say, I have a right to judge, right? And that's what we do critically. And some critics are harsh, and I think harshness is required sometimes. So I'm not going to tell people, no, like the Stalinist version, go mix with the masses, maybe something will grow on you, right? And you'll be gone. I'm not going to tell you that. But I'm going to tell you, right, critically, that there's this big historical reality which affects all Palestinians and all Arabs. And that's a problem. And part of being a committed writer is to engage this reality whichever way you see necessary or deem important. But I think that's an important reality. That's all I'm saying. Right?
We've got a few questions going on. So one there.
Yeah, okay. Should we just go, if you've got the microphone just there, so if you just pass it to the person there, and then we'll come here in the front.
Just taking a note of the reassessment of the contemporary culture, in terms of the writers that you mentioned, the schism of 48, what about the current schism of maybe the Arab Spring, and how is that being played out within literature?
See, the problem with the Arab Spring is that in terms of its impact on Palestine, it's been negligible. And now we're living in a reactionary moment where, you know, the Arab world is living a catastrophe of Syria. I mean, the Syrian situation is beyond words, people being dispossessed out of Aleppo, on a daily basis by a brutal regime, by Russian imperialism. It's just sickening to watch. So that, what happened to the Palestinians in 48 is happening again and again, and in worse terms. You know, sometimes I think we should gauge a measure of what Israel does to the Palestinians. Maybe Arabs don't want to gauge that measure because we're so motivated by fighting Israel. But you know, if the Israelis kill 200,000 Palestinians in Gaza, there'll be demonstrations night and day outside the embassies and outside the foreign office here. The Syrian regime killed more. Why? Because it kills its own people, it's okay. Right? Foreigners killing other people is not okay, but regimes killing their own people, that makes it fine. So I think, so if you want to begin to talk about the Arab Spring, we have to begin to talk about the defeat of the 2011-2012 moment, which was a very important moment. And it was a moment which constitutes a regional challenge for the regimes, for Israel, I think, for the West. Israel doesn't like democracy in the Middle East. The West doesn't like democracy in the Middle East. Suddenly, Saudi Arabia doesn't like democracy in the Middle East. The Gulfies don't like democracy in the Middle East. Because it means that you have to overturn these regimes. And I think it's absolutely fine to think you have to overturn these regimes. I think there's no other answer to the Arab world. I think on some level, for us to begin to deal with Israel, you have to deal with Saudi Arabia. Right? And you have to deal with Qatar. And you have to deal with the Syrian regime. So, does that produce a new literature? Yes, absolutely. Will the contemporary novel be affected by it? Yes, but the situation now is regressing, right, politically. The moment of hope that we had in 2011-2012, which was a moment where you felt years of really knowing the Arab world and understanding what people really are, were not being done justice to. And suddenly, because there are people tell you about the West, where they look at the Arab world, they say, oh, look, you know, it's all Muslims. Right? Muslims think about religion all the time. Right? Because if you want to understand the Arab world, read the Quran. If you want to understand why people blow themselves up, go to page 17 in the Quran. The explanation is there. So what do Arabs want? The Arabs, they want to go to the mosque, they want to veil, they want more religion. But then you had this explosion. And that these explosions are important in order to correct. Some people never get corrected, so I'm not telling you that, you know, when people see reality, they change their mind. Some people hold on to it more. But if you want to respond to that reality and try to understand its underlying causes, you have to understand that these people are making universal demands. And that's what chimes in with the 60s and 70s generation. People who went down to protest in Egypt made universal demands. They didn't make any particularist demand about Islam or Arab culture. They wanted bread, they wanted dignity, they wanted justice. Everybody wants that. And there's something beautiful about the universality of the Arab Spring. Now, it's being crushed, sure. I don't think it's over. So this is an ongoing process. I hope the next wave of protest will be stronger, and I hope it'll overturn more regimes, and it'll tackle the head of the problem, right? Which has been spreading reaction in the Arab world since the defeat of Nasser in the 60s. Nasser had his own problems. He was a popular dictator, but extremely popular. So when he resigned, people went out, you know, dictators can be a user. So when Saudi Arabia won the Arab Cold War, we're still living in that moment until 2011. I think that will return. And I think the Arab world has to, the only answer to the problems that the Arab world is facing is social justice and democracy. There is no answer. And that goes in Yemen, where the Saudis are having a field day and starving a whole population. That goes in Russia, in Syria, where the Russians and the Syrians are starving a whole population for political outcomes. That goes in the West Bank and Gaza. That goes in Israel. That goes in Jordan. So on some level, one figure that we could have talked about in relationship to Jabra is Abd al-Rahman Munif, the Saudi writer, right? Who wrote one of the most beautiful novels, actually, very difficult novel, A World Without Maps, Alam Bila Kharait, published in 1982. Very beautiful novel. And it shows you both those energies, the bourgeois writer, slumming it with a socialist, right? And writing a novel together. So how bourgeois can you be if you think about Abd al-Rahman Munif as a figure you want to emulate and write with? So I think that combination is important, not only aesthetically, but also politically. But I'm not prescribing.
Hi. Sorry to change the subject, because okay, this is a whole event in itself. But Bashir, who wishes my command, You asked us to push you, so
okay.
I will. Tell us about Palestinian cinema today, what it's doing better than contemporary fiction and the novel, and please name names.
I heard my wife go. I usually listen to my wife. So here's the problem, I think, yeah? And I think about it in terms of people I know, friends of mine who are deeply involved in Palestinian cinema. And I think that's the nature of the problem. The nature of the problem is one I tried to tackle with the novel. It is, what do you do when you're working aesthetically and culturally, and in a sense chiming in with a political moment which has horizon, emancipatory horizon, progressive horizon, social, progressive social horizon. So what happens to you aesthetically, right, when you build your whole identity and worldview around this moment, and this just doesn't go for culture, but it goes to people on the left politically as well. What happens when that moment historically disappears? What happens to your aesthetic, right? And I think that's a challenge. So what do you do in your writing when everything you ever wanted and all the anchors around you, which give you meaning, give you coherence, right, suddenly disappear? So you... And that's, I think about it in terms of a crisis. And I see it, if you want to name names, I'm happy to name names. I see it, for example, in the work of Michel Khalifi, who epitomizes the height of emancipated Palestinian culture in his early work, and his foundational work. The height of it. Right? Most progressive over women. Aesthetically, very complicated, very everyday. His beautiful image is so incredibly... in line with ordinary Palestinian feeling. He knows how to do popular life. Very few writers know how to do popular life. He understands it very well. So then you get this momentum going, right? Wedding in Galilee, his early work, you get this momentum going. If you ask yourself, what happens when that political momentum is not there? What happens to the aesthetic? That's part of how the crisis that Palestinians have been experiencing. And I think, in part, it's a loss of ground. Now, some people see the loss of ground as a huge opportunity because they can invent themselves. But I think part of what it means to be a modernist, so I think modernism is celebrated as some kind of... I think most modernists don't understand modernism. They think it's some kind of banal flashbacks, complicated narrative structure. It's all very empowering, and it allows you to have good dinner conversations on London dinner tables, right? Because you're a sophisticated writer. But modernism is deeply tragic. Deeply tragic. Modernism is about the loss of your ability to understand the world around you because the world has changed. It is about a fundamental crisis in knowledge, in society. So the question becomes, how do you reflect that crisis aesthetically? I think Michel tried to do it in Zindiq. Right? I think Zindiq is Michel Khalifi's way of trying to articulate the crisis, which is historical, which what happens to the individual... to the Palestinian individual who was always core and important in the Palestinian emancipatory struggle. What happens to that individual when there is no emancipatory struggle anymore? What happens to that individual? And in part, some of the literature shows that the individual disintegrates. It's completely liquidated. It is incapable of knowing what is real and what is not real. And that's a historical crisis. Now, some people see the crisis as celebratory. I don't think there's anything to celebrate about this crisis. I think the fundamental measures of this crisis is that it's a deep tragedy. It's fundamentally modernism. There's something deeply tragic about modernism because it's about your own way of understanding the world which has completely changed. You're incapable of doing it anymore. If you think about Adorno, if you think about Virginia Woolf, all the theorists and writers around modernism, it's seen as a loss of connection, a loss of coherence. Now, some people see this loss as an opportunity for me time. Fine. Okay? Fine. I don't think aesthetically there's anything interesting about what they do. That's what I'm telling you. Because I think it's much more important to convey the nature of the crisis. That's, in a sense, maybe that's why I stop at some point in the account of the novel, right? Because I didn't want to be unfair to the contemporary generation. I didn't engage with it enough to judge it enough. So I just thought, for that founding generation of Palestinian novelists, that's where one would stop. Some people saw the crisis, articulated it, and tried to gauge a form. If you read Jabra, The Other Rooms, it's an incredible novel, a very short novel in Arabic. It hasn't been translated, tragically. But it's an incredible novel because it shows you the notion of individual failure. The individual simply doesn't know anymore who they are. And they're not to blame for it, right? And this is not just an opportunity, great opportunity to write home about, right? This is a deep crisis. So that's where I would go with this.
And you've brought it right back to the book that you've written, so I'm very mindful of the time. So if you've got other questions, do come up and ask Bashir when we've finished. But I did profess a hope at the beginning for intellectual warmth, but I feel we've had a lot of that, but also a huge amount of rigour and very, very enthusiastic critical thinking. So for that, I am hugely, hugely grateful, and
you've
taught me a huge amount in writing this book and this evening. Thank you very much indeed. Buy the book, read it. He's amazing. Thank you very much.